From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. This week, the concept of Manny being Manny took on even stranger dimensions. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll discuss Major League Baseball's latest 50-game suspension. Also, the New York Yankees and the city they represent balk at plans to restore parklands lost to the new stadium in the Bronx, and the Phoenix Coyotes begin baying at the moon over Ontario. Also ahead, a reenactment of the first intercollegiate baseball game, which happened 150 years ago and included a cerebral dalliance.
I think the original challenge came from Amherst for a baseball match, and then Williams counter-challenge with a chess match so that it could be a battle of both the mind and the body.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Manny didn't say it wasn't so when the news broke on Thursday that he'd been suspended for 50 games for violating Major League Baseball's substance abuse policy. In a statement issued the same day, Manny Ramirez stressed that his doctor had prescribed medication that was not a steroid and he was taking it for a personal health issue. Subsequent statements by unnamed sources suggest that the substance Manny had in his system was HCG, a women's fertility drug sometimes taken by steroid users to restart their body's natural testosterone production as they come off a steroid cycle. I'm joined now by Tim Kirkjian of ESPN for some baseball talk that has to start with Manny, I'm afraid. Tim, were you surprised?
I was surprised, Bill, but, you know, I shouldn't be surprised anymore, nor should anybody else, no matter whose name comes up. This story is even bigger than we thought it was, and it's been going on for years and years, and we keep being told there were hundreds of players involved, and now you have to think there were a bunch of other players, maybe a bunch of other star players who were involved that we don't know about. And that's the hardest part about this, is we still don't know very much about what we're dealing with here, but we know this much. Manny Ramirez did something wrong, and he is going to have to pay for it.
Is HCG baseball's new banned substance du jour?
Well, it's only been on the banned substance list for a year, so maybe it's a new one. Who knows? But for Manny to come out and say, well, it was just an honest mistake, a doctor forgot to tell me, for what this thing actually does, it helps restore testosterone after you've been on your steroid cycle. Hello, you can't look at that any other way than he must have been doing a steroid cycle. I mean, I'm not the most naive guy in the world. I'm close. But, I have a hard time believing this one.
The Dodgers have gotten off to a great start, a record-breaking start at home. But how well will they do for the next 50 games without Manny?
Obviously, they're going to struggle without him. I mean, you look at the numbers since he showed up, July 31st of last year. They have scored a half run per game more on average than the team without Manny, and that is a significant gap. And they are going to miss him, no question, in the middle of the order. However, I fully expect him to be a really good player when he comes back, and I fully expect them to go to the postseason with that team, not because they're a great, great team, but because the rest of the division, I don't even think, can catch up when Manny's out.
What are the financial implications of the positive drug test likely to be for Manny and for the Dodgers?
Well, Manny's going to lose upwards of $7 million. It's almost a third of the season, and we will have no compassion for him in that respect. The Dodgers, however, have built an entire marketing campaign around Manny. There's a portion of the left field stands called Mannywood, in which you can buy two tickets and two T-shirts total and for $99, Manny's number, mm-hmm. and go sit in those seats and wear dreadlocks and look like an idiot. But that's what people do. In L.A., and he is beloved there. I mean, it's like Kobe Bryant, then Manny Ramirez in Southern California. That's the list. And for him to, basically betray, that's probably not the right word, but certainly disappoint these people the way that he has, it's a really bad sign.
Elsewhere in negative baseball news, 8 major league teams have experienced drops in attendance of between 12 and 39% so far this season. The Yankees and the Mets are both way down, as are the Blue Jays, the Braves, and the Tigers. What are the consequences of this drop likely to be?
I was worried from day one of this season that the economic problems in this country would transfer to baseball. There's no reason that they shouldn't, and a bunch of teams would really struggle, as has been the case. Now, I'll give a bunch of teams the benefit of the doubt. It's been lousy weather this spring. Kids are still in school. Wait till things warm up. Wait till the pennant races really begin, and more people will show up. But there is a chance that the economic problems are not going to be solved at all in baseball. We're going to have a bunch of teams that are going to struggle at the gate, struggle with sponsorship, struggle with marketing, and have to say, you know, in May, you know, late May, early June, hey, this isn't working. We're going to have to trade one of our best, most expensive players because we just can't afford to do business this way anymore.
One of the early season's best stories involves Zach Greinke, the pitcher for the Kansas City Royals, who is 6-0 with an ERA of 0.40. But in this guy's case, I gather the stats are only the beginning of a terrific story.
Yeah, it's a great story here, Bill. Unfortunately, he doesn't want to talk about it, and maybe for obvious reasons. This is a guy who has had great ability from the day he got to the big leagues 5 years ago as a 20-year-old. He was unusually advanced in knowledge of how to pitch and that type of thing. However, he's had all sorts of emotional issues, social anxiety issues, to the point where he just broke down in tears in front of his manager, Buddy Bell, a few years ago and had to leave spring training because the pressures of the job and everything else in his life just became too great for him, and he had to go away for a while. Well, now he's back. No one is suggesting that he's 100% cured from whatever issues that he had, but he sure is not taking any of that out to the field because he has been absolutely spectacular. And you take those numbers and you look in the history of baseball, only two other pitchers have ever had those numbers at this stage of the year. One was Walter Johnson, greatest pitcher of all time, and the other was Fernando Valenzuela in 1981, who was the greatest pitching phenomenon we've seen in the last 30 years.
Kansas City is off to a better start than most people might have anticipated. Which teams have surprised you by not starting as well as you thought they might?
Well, I thought the Yankees certainly would be better than this. They've had terrible pitching problems. I think those are going to get solved eventually. The Mets haven't been particularly good, although they're starting to play a little bit better here. Even the Cubs, who I thought would be, you know, not the runaway winner, but the clear favorite in the NL Central, they haven't played particularly well. Even the world champion Phillies, even though they're in first place, they've struggled up and down. And there's a point here, Bill. There are no great teams out there. I mean, teams win the World Series every year, but you can win without a great team. And I see more teams heading towards the middle. The days are over where teams just run away and hide, because there are just a lot of decent teams out there and not very many great teams.
ESPN's Tim Kirkjian joins me for some good baseball talk from time to time, whether or not the actual news is good. Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
The Yankees and the city of New York have so far not made good on promises to replace about 32 acres of public parkland lost to construction of the Yankees' expensive new ballpark. Many local sports teams and recreational athletes await a resolution, including the varsity baseball players at the All Hallows School, a 100-year-old all-boys Catholic high school that sits in the shadows of the Yankees' old stadium and their new one. Only a Game's Kirk Carapeza reports.
Like the New York Yankees, the All Hallows High School varsity baseball team wears pinstripes. After school on a recent Friday afternoon, the All Hallows Gales pack their gear and prepare for what's technically a home game. Since the Yankees began construction of their new $1.5 billion stadium 3 years ago on the Gales' former home field at McCombs Dam Park, the team has been forced to practice wherever it can, including the school cafeteria, and to play home games away from home.
It's difficult.
Ken Dominich is a retired New York City police officer and the assistant coach of the Gales.
It's difficult. Not having the space, not having the facilities to work out a baseball team the way you wanted to. We're tight on space.
Outside, 14 teammates pack into a small bus. The remaining five hop into a coach's car. The players won't say it, but the loss of their home facilities has put the team, now 0-8, at a disadvantage.
You go to the game, Mr. Sullivan?
Yeah, I got to clear up some things on the desk. I'll be over there.
See you guys in a bit.
All right.
Over there is the West Bronx home field of tonight's opponent, Regis High School, which is listed on the schedule as the visiting team. and Mr. Sullivan is All Hallows principal Sean Sullivan, who watches as the team bus heads for the Cross Bronx Expressway and their so-called home field 6 miles away. Sullivan grew up in the Bronx and graduated from All Hallows 36 years ago. He played left field for the varsity team from 1972 to 1973. Wearing a Yankees hat, he admits that the park's issue has split his loyalties between his school and his favorite pro team. He says the Yankees did offer some support, but only after the school had to purchase 2 buses at a cost of $75,000.
They asked us, what can they do anything for us? And we said, yeah, because you took our fields, we have to run around the city now with our buses. We can't afford it. We don't have much money. And we got a pitching machine. You can't drive a pitching machine. It's 300 pounds. It's huge. It's a professional pitching machine, and I got a small high school. It's useless to us.
And lost park space in the Bronx has affected more than just the Gales and other local sports teams. When the city council approved the new Yankee Stadium plan back in August of 2006, the Yankees organization and the city parks department promised to provide replacement ball fields to serve community residents. But nearly 3 years after construction of the new stadium began, the old one still stands, and just one temporary 3-acre track and field facility is open in the vicinity of the two stadiums. No permanent parks have been completed. At City Hall last week, City Council members received an update on the status of replacement parkland in the South Bronx.
5 years from now, 10 years from now, we're still going to be talking about it.
Jeffrey Croft is the president of NYC Park Advocates. He was born and raised on 167th Street in the Bronx, on the outskirts of McCombs Dam Park.
You know, these parklands are years behind schedule. They came up with phony estimates, phony completion dates. Well, everything's phony. The only thing that wasn't phony was that the Yankees were going to build and build on time.
Under federal law, the City Parks Department must eventually replace all 25.3 acres of parkland lost to the Yankees' new stadium. But many residents and advocates have argued those parks will have to be located outside the community. 2.5 hours after the Gales departed for the West Bronx, the bus pulls back into the school parking lot. Their game has been suspended after 1 2/3 innings due to rain. Diogenes Montano, a 17-year-old 5'8" senior, is the catcher and co-captain of the Gales. He admits that the constant traveling wears on him and his teammates.
It didn't seem right. Home team, we had maybe 1 or 2 parents there, no kids from the school.
Though they're frustrated, Montano says the team is trying to enjoy the moment. He realizes this could be the last time they play organized baseball.
Because college baseball is another whole other level. And so that's why you try to go out here and play every game like it's our last.
2 blocks east of the school, the Yankees are opening a homestand against the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. A tide of blue descends from the elevated train suspended between the old and new stadiums. The Yankees will later edge out the Angels 10-9, thanks to Jorge Posada's walk-off single in the bottom of the ninth. The catcher of the Gales says tonight, like most nights, he and his teammates will walk home together. For Only a Game, I'm Kirk Carapeza in New York.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The proprietors of a high-end bakery in Split, Croatia, had a problem. Thieves were breaking into their shop about once a week. So a month ago, the owners plastered a life-sized poster of action star Chuck Norris in the front window over a sign that read, "This shop is under the protection of Chuck Norris." They've had no break-ins since. It started as a joke, said sales assistant Mirna Kovac, but it has really worked. People seem to respect him. We have had a few customers come in and ask whether they can get Chuck's autograph. They really believe he's sitting in our storeroom out the back, ready to pounce on any burglars.
Because that's where the Rangers gonna be. In the eyes of a Ranger, the unsuspecting stranger.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a baseball game at which Abraham Lincoln would have been comfortable. But first, in NBA playoff action last night, the Los Angeles Lakers looked very much like the finalist lots of people think they'll be in sinking the Houston Rockets 108-94. Kobe Bryant scored 33 points in a game that put LA up 2 games to 1 in the Western Conference semifinal series. In Orlando, the Magic all but made the Boston Celtics disappear in Game 3 of their Eastern Conference semifinal series, 117-96. Boston trails in that series 2-1. In postseason NHL action, the Pittsburgh Penguins, scoring early and late, beat the Washington Capitals 5-3 in a game that saw Sidney Crosby outscore Alex Ovechkin 1-0. Each team has won 2 games in that series. Meanwhile, in Raleigh, North Carolina, the Hurricanes swept away the Bruins, who adopted the curious strategy of hibernating in the third period, during which Carolina scored 3 times. The Hurricanes lead that series 3-1. On Tuesday, the Phoenix Coyotes filed for bankruptcy. Shortly thereafter, NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman jetted to Arizona with league attorneys who appeared in federal court and informed the judge that since November, the league, not titular owner Jerry Moyes, has had control of the team. Mr. Moyes would prefer to accept Canadian billionaire Jim Balsillie's $212.5 million offer for the Coyotes. Mr. Balsillie's offer stipulates that the team would have to move to Hamilton, Ontario, where, he argues, the Coyotes would finally thrive. Here to help us chronicle the woes of one of the NHL's original 30 teams is Ray Ratto, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Ray, welcome back to Only a Game.
How are you?
Very good, thank you. Commissioner Bettman has stated that the league MO has always been to try everything short of moving a troubled team from one city to another. But given the fact that the Coyotes are about $300 million in debt, is it wise for the league to keep them in Arizona?
Well, keeping the team in Arizona is not good for the league, but it is good for the Maple Leafs. And I think that is driving a lot of this. Toronto doesn't need a near neighbor. Hamilton is not that far from Buffalo. And every time franchises get moved in every sport, eventually some blame leaches onto the commissioner of that sport.
Well, let's talk a little history here. In 1996, the Coyotes moved from Winnipeg to Phoenix, where they shared a home arena with the NBA's Suns. That team never really took hold. So why did the city of Glendale put up $180 million for a new stadium to move the team there?
Because they thought it would be a great idea, a chance to turn Glendale into a hub. Even the traffic alone is a deal breaker. You go out 10 West, it's a nightmare that time of day. So it's a real hard slog. And frankly, Phoenix has not expanded to the west side of town the way it had hoped it would. Glendale is probably the worst place to have put that arena.
In the lucrative 90s, Canadian hockey fans lamented the expansion of the NHL through America's Sun Belt. Would a new team in Hamilton, Ontario, which is where Mr. Balsillie would like to see the Coyotes end up, be a vindication of sorts for hockey fans north of the border?
Well, I think it would, and I think it is clear that it would do well there because with only a few exceptions this year in Ottawa, every game in every Canadian city was sold out. I mean, it is still Canada's national game. It is still incredibly popular. And even with the Canadian dollar taking a bit of a beating, it's still their version of the NFL.
Jim Balsillie failed twice to purchase and relocate National Hockey League teams, and some claim that his latest offer was just made to irritate Gary Bettman. Is there more to the offer than that?
I think he wants in. I think he's wanted in for a while. But I think this time there is a level of irritation involved because when you've been told no twice, it's pretty clear that the current group of owners don't want you as part of the club. Balsillie's theory is, I'm not leaving. I'm going to get a team because pretty soon you're going to have more inventory for sale than you want to admit to. And you can fight me here if you want, because nobody else seems to be for sale right now. But you are going to have other teams in crisis the longer this economic problem goes on. And I'm going to be around for all of it. And eventually one of them has to go to me. And when it does, I want to move it to the place where I know it's going to thrive.
What do you think is the best possible outcome for this particular hockey drama?
I think the best outcome, you know, it sort of depends on where your ox is gored. I think for the league that is not making tons of money off national TV product, the best place is a place where the building will be full every night, and it can get a piece of the CBC and TSN money, which are the two networks up in Canada. So I think Southern Ontario is the best place for it. But the logic of this flies in the face of Gary Bettman's long-held theory that you have to make the NHL a national American sport. I think he would be perfectly willing maybe to let Balsillie buy it and move it to Seattle, say, or Portland. But those really aren't, you know, great NHL cities. I think they would be willing to think about him taking it to Kansas City, even though that's really not a great NHL city. But Balsillie wants to go to the place where the money is, and the money is in Southern Ontario.
Ray Ratto is a sports columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's been watching the desert hockey team representing Phoenix or Glendale or whatever it may represent next from the Bay Area. Ray, thanks very much for speaking with me.
All righty, Bill.
And it's going back, way back in time, that is. About 150 years ago, Williams College and Amherst College played the first intercollegiate baseball game. Only a Game's Doug Tribou was present last weekend for a commemorative reenactment.
The fans are eating peanuts and hot dogs. The grass is perfectly manicured. And there's the occasional crack of the bat and roar of the crowd. It's an overcast May Sunday afternoon, and at first glance, there's nothing out of the ordinary here at Wacona Park in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. But the Williams College and Amherst College baseball alumni on the field had a lot of rules to learn.
What we would consider home plate is actually fourth base. Home plate is actually midway between first base and fourth base.
The bases are sticks.
Underhand pitching.
And the other thing is you don't have a glove, so you're just using your bare hands to catch the ball.
The ball's bigger and softer, and you can throw it at the guy and hit him and get him out.
There's no foul territory. Everything's in play.
So you can hit a foul ball out of the yard, and you'll get a home run out of it.
150 years ago, those were part of the Massachusetts rules for baseball, one of two sets in use at the time. Today's game is a reenactment of the first intercollegiate baseball game, which was played on July 1, 1859. Jim Briggs played baseball at Williams and later coached the team for more than 20 seasons. Briggs was a student when the game was recreated on the 100th anniversary in 1959. Both colleges are in western Massachusetts, but he says the rivalry between the schools goes much deeper than geography and athletic competitions.
The Williams president left Williams because they thought Williams was too far up in the woods and the sticks and took a few faculty members. We always claim he took some library books and went down and started Amherst in 1821. So we've always called them the defectors of 1821. It's just a neat rivalry. You play them every year in every sport.
Amherst alum and former Boston Red Sox general manager Dan Duquette was one of the principal organizers of the reenactment. Duquette says although Wacona Park wasn't built until 1892, it's the perfect place to honor the rivalry and the history of baseball in Pittsfield.
There's no dispute that these two teams played the first ball game. They played it just a couple of blocks from here, up on the corner of North and Maplewood, which is where St. Joseph's High School is now. And it solidifies Pittsfield's position as the birthplace of college baseball.
On the field, the coaches are dressed in tuxedos with white ties, tails, and top hats, as they were in 1859. The players are wearing long, untucked jerseys that look like oversized polo shirts with lacing instead of buttons and short-brimmed caps that say 1859. The first striker, or batter, for the Eaves flies out on the first pitch. In 1859, there was only one out per inning, so Williams quickly takes the field. Amherst scores seven tallies, or runs, in their half of the first inning. In the stands, the fans enthusiastically support their teams as they try to sort out this 19th century version of the national pastime. Mark and Pat Allen are sitting on the third base side and rooting for Amherst, Mark's alma mater.
What's the oddest thing that you've seen as a foul ball home run goes over our heads?
That's correct. Foul ball home runs.
In any direction, behind you, in front of you, whatever.
There's one man in charge of enforcing the 1859 rules. Umpire Jim Ferry has worked more than 30 vintage baseball games. He's wearing a derby, a top coat with tails, and leans on a walking stick while standing behind the mound. The hurlers, or pitchers, throw underhand, and Ferry says the batters enjoy other advantages.
They tell them exactly where they want it, and they're supposed to be able to put it in there so they can hit it. So the pitching has completely changed between 1859 and today, because if a pitcher threw the ball so the people could hit it, I don't think he'd last too long.
Pittsburgh Pirates chairman and principal owner Bob Nutting is a graduate of Williams. He's here to read a proclamation from Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig, recognizing the historic anniversary for the colleges and the city of Pittsfield. Nutting says it's interesting to see the evolution of the game.
It's fun for me. I watched a little bit of cricket over the summer last year, and watching the connection between both cricket with the stakes, running back and forth, all balls in play, and see the slow migration toward real bases in baseball.
The details of the reenactment extend beyond baseball. In 1859, the colleges held a two-day affair that also included chess. Amherst won the original chess tournament. Today, the college's chess clubs are facing off under a tent near the entrance to the park. Trevor Murphy is an instructional technology specialist at Williams and also serves as the chess club advisor.
I think the original challenge came from Amherst for a baseball match, and then Williams counter-challenge with a chess match so that it could be a battle of both the mind and the body.
In 1859, the baseball teams agreed that the first squad to score 65 tallies would be the winner. After 25 innings, Amherst won by a final score of 73-32. Today, the alumni only have an hour before the real game between the two schools' current teams. After seven innings and several home runs, Williams is declared the winner by a score of 19-17. Rich Thompson graduated from Amherst in 1980 and pitched for three seasons for the Cleveland Indians and Montreal Expos. He says 1859 baseball had at least one similarity to the modern game.
Well, I played in the major leagues, so I'm used to getting hit hard like I was today, so that was nothing new.
This afternoon's real game between the Eafs and the Lord Jeffs has more at stake than just bragging rights. Williams has already qualified for the championship tournament in the New England Small Schools Athletic Conference, but Amherst needs to win to make the postseason. Before the game, both sides take time to recognize the end of an important chapter in the rivalry. Amherst head coach Bill Thurston is coaching his final regular season game after 44 seasons and more than 800 victories with the Lord Jeffs. Thurston threw out the ceremonial first pitch using an 1859-style ball.
Coach, Amherst and all of your players thank you and will remember your countless contributions to the school and their lives. Bill Thurston.
In the end, it's a clean sweep for Williams. The Eafs won the reenactment, took the chess tournament 3-1, and then won the real baseball game by a score of 8-5, ending the Lord Jeffs season. Amherst leads the all-time series 191-132 with two ties. Williams class of 1985 alum Mike Coakley says even though the reenactment game was all in good fun, both sides wanted the victory.
I mean, it goes back so long that when you play Amherst, it's always the biggest game of the year because we're still talking about it from 25 years ago. That, you know, we beat them or they beat us, and it's a heated rivalry.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
You're listening to Only a Game. Our games are many things to many people. For one of commentator Alyssa Eli's relatives, sports is a matter of life.
He's close to 100, my uncle. His hearing's acute, his prow teeth are his own, and his mind is sharper than yours. He lives on the top floor of a duplex where his TV, the great love left in his life, is always on. On this great love, he watches sports, only sports. Between innings or quarters or holes or sets, he limps down the hall to fix himself a milkshake. Sometimes he cooks himself a pot roast, but only when it's between games. In order to talk to him, I have to accommodate his tight schedule. I turn my television to his sports channel and then dial like the wind when commercials come on. Often the wind doesn't blow fast enough and I miss my opportunity. Some handsome man has just stopped shaving with his exceptional new razor, or some photogenic group has finished their delicious beers. "I'm in the middle of a game, honey," he says. "I'll call you back." But he never calls back because another game comes on afterwards. 99 has been an arduous age for him. This winter was almost impossible. The one friend he had left died. He fell once or twice, stepping out on his deck, and had to wait until a neighbor noticed the lights were off in the apartment before being rescued. He started medication for back pain and headaches. On the phone, he began to wonder about the sense of turning 100. I wondered, too. Last week, I called to ask about his health. "It's terrible," he said. "The doctor won't operate on his cataract, and his perfect teeth hurt. But it's also baseball season, which means 162 games. That's a lot of pot roast." "So, honey," he said, sounding more cheerful than I've heard in a while, "don't call me in the middle of any of them." Then he hung up on me because the commercial was over. Salvation is an individual process. Personally, I've always preferred documentaries when it comes to television. But I'm not sure they will keep a man alive.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist living near Boston. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And Decordova Museum and Sculpture Park, presenting modern and contemporary sculpture and art on 35 acres, 15 miles from Boston in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Details at decordova.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ultimate Frisbee may be the ultimate in anything goes sports. There are no referees, and players are expected to call fouls on themselves. But the team from the University of Oregon, ranked third in the nation, found recently that there are limits even in ultimate. During an April game against Oregon State, five members of the University of Oregon team removed their pants. They protested that they were wearing really long shirts, but the student board that governs the sport was unimpressed. The board canceled the rest of the team's season, in part because the lads had already been on probation for serving alcohol to minors and making too much noise at a party. Sandy Hammerly, executive director of the sport's national governing body, approved of the ruling. "You have to wear clothing," she said. "It's in the rules." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, cricket crashes Eastern Europe. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's speaking to me today from WUOT in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
As of Thursday afternoon, Manny just being Manny took on a new meaning. What's your take on Mr. Ramirez's 50-game suspension for violating the league's substance abuse policy?
I'm of two minds of this. I have defended this guy against a lot of what I believe is cheap and rather distasteful heckling from the fainting couch where the baseball Nazis go every time somebody doesn't respect the game. I'm also of two minds because this was a test not for a steroid but for a masking agent, which means you're one step removed, which means pretty soon we're going to be 19 steps removed, and that this problem, if it is indeed a problem, is never going to be solved. The worst thing about this event is that it gives a lot of really arrogant people a chance to gloat, which is always a bad thing. That said, if you're going to have this regime in place, as futile and contrary to the movement of history and science as it is, then this is probably an appropriate punishment.
The Mavericks' defeat of the San Antonio Spurs in the first round of the NBA playoffs must have heartened the legions of Dallas fans accustomed to the team's recent playoff failures, Charlie, but oops, the Mavs are down 2-0 going into today's home game against Denver. Are we witnessing the end of the Dirk Nowitzki era?
I think what you saw with Dallas-San Antonio was two teams watching the window closing, and with San Antonio, you heard it slam shut. With Dallas, it's still a couple of inches above the sill. Block that metaphor! Anyway, I think what you're seeing also is the fact of a couple of very wise NBA people told me this, that the most dangerous team in the playoffs that nobody was considering a factor were the Denver Nuggets. They're enormously talented. They're very young, and they're in the playoffs, really, with the first kind of genuine shot they've had in a long time. But they can beat a lot of people.
The NBA's league office decided not to suspend the Lakers' Kobe Bryant for his elbow to Houston's Ron Artest during Game 2 of that playoff series on Wednesday. Following the game, Artest told reporters that he had played in a really physical game in which a guy was murdered. This was not during his NBA career, but before it. Do you suppose he was putting the scribes on?
Well, who knows? I mean, it's entirely possible. Although if you kill a guy during a game, I think your suspension should last until that guy is able to come back and play again.
Former basketball star Dave Bing was elected mayor of Detroit on Tuesday. Good for him, but he won with only 15% of the voters turning out to vote. Would it be accurate to say that fewer people turned out to vote than turned out for some of the games in which Dave Bing played?
If I might just say, bingo, which is the way they used to greet his very nice-looking jump shot.
Now he's his honor bingo.
Now he is his honor bingo, exactly. I don't know, but it is nice, though, because Dave Bing can now personally buy a hamburger for everyone who voted for him. Let's face facts. Anybody who volunteers to step out there and be mayor of Detroit at this point, given the state of the city and what happened to the previous mayor, has all my support. And the fact that he's one of the best point guards I ever saw is only a bonus.
The Phoenix Coyotes filed for bankruptcy this week, after which NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman and his lawyers said they'd like a dismissal since they had been running the team since November, and now the league and team owner Jerry Moyes will apparently fight over whether the team can be sold and moved to Hamilton, Ontario. Are the glory days of Sunbelt hockey dwindling?
This was an experiment right there along with having two NHL teams in Florida that never should have taken place. I hope they move to Hamilton, if only to have that old guy, Harold Ballard, the former guy who used to own the Leafs, rotate even faster on his barbecue spit in hell. Hamilton's deserved a hockey team for an awfully long time, and it certainly should be one that Phoenix has shown no signs of supporting.
After Brett Favre had briefly flirted with the Minnesota Vikings this week, his agent said that his whimsical client is still retired. So, quick, Charlie, before he changes his mind, comment on this.
Oh, please, no, I don't. Play, don't play, you're over the hill, no one cares, go away. That's my theory on Brett Favre.
The commissioners of the National Hockey League, the NBA, Major League Baseball, and the NFL met in New York on Thursday to discuss the future of sports. This must have been fascinating. Anyway, regarding the recession and a dramatic drop in attendance at baseball games, Commissioner Selig said, quote, "The clubs have been remarkably sensitive." You suppose he had the Yankees in mind?
The clubs have been remarkably sensitive to what an enormous mistake they've made. Yeah, I'm sure he talked about the Yankees. I was wondering when they all got together, did they find the future of sports? Because I've been looking for it. I thought it was pretty much Tiger Woods and LeBron James.
Who knows? That may have been where they got to at the end of the discussion. I don't know. Michael Phelps acknowledged this week that he didn't even realize his suspension from competition for using marijuana was over. Can you explain this?
Yes, it can be explained in one word. Dude! Whoa! That's two words, actually.
I guess he probably...
I can swim again!
He probably had been doing a fair amount of swimming even while suspended. There just wasn't anybody in the lane next to him.
That's right.
Singapore officials have decided that nobody is worthy of the 2008 Sportsman of the Year Award. Singapore National Olympic Council Secretary General Chris Chan announced, quote, Unfortunately, it was a bad year. None of them really achieved anything noteworthy. Wouldn't it have been better to have just let that circumstance pass unremarked upon?
No, I think he's telling his athletes to get on the stick. I mean, look, we have this trophy. We wanted to put someone's name on it. Now it's going to be blank for 2008.
Finally, Charlie, it was learned yesterday that Moonlit Path tested positive for a banned substance before a race last February at Huntingdon in England. This probably wouldn't have made the headlines here, except that this particular horse is owned by Queen Elizabeth.
Queen Elizabeth! Dude!
In a statement, Her Majesty said that a doctor had given the horse the substance
in order to treat
a private and personal medical problem.
No, they didn't really say that.
No.
Because there's no way the Queen Elizabeth and Manny Ramirez say the same thing ever.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, dude!
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear our program and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860, and you can visit our website, onlyagame.org. Cricket is popular in much of the world, the United Kingdom, for example, and India and Pakistan. It is not especially popular or even much evident in Bulgaria, Slovakia, or Serbia. Why, then, was Angus Bell determined to travel to those places and other equally unlikely cricket venues to play the game? Some of the answers are in his new book, Batting on the Bosphorus, A Liquor-Fueled Cricket Tour Through Eastern Europe. Angus Bell joins me now from the studios of the CBC in Montreal to discuss such things as how to get out of Belarus with lots of cricket gear, no money, and a visa that's about to expire. Angus Bell, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks very much for having me.
The phrase liquor-fueled in the subtitle of your book goes some distance toward explaining what you set out to do, but tell me more about the trip that you planned.
Well, this is essentially a book about an 8,000-mile Skoda-powered road trip through the former Soviet bloc. It took me through 17 former Warsaw Pact and Soviet bloc countries like Estonia, all the way down to Serbia and Bosnia, back up through Ukraine and Belarus, playing the Englishman's game of cricket.
Mm-hmm. And we better go back for just a minute. Skoda, you better explain the vehicle.
Skoda, well, this is the ultimate Eastern European car. My Skoda was actually a good one, not one of the ones with the papier-mâché walls and the fuel you had to mix by hand. You know, it was a hardy beast that survived jaunts through Bosnian minefields and could survive carjackings. And it could double up as a sandwich bar on the roads, too.
Who would want a carjacking?
A carjacking. Oh, great experience.
How did you go about locating cricket players in these various places in Eastern Europe?
Well, I'll tell you how this all started. It all started here in Montreal, would you believe it, at a psychic exposition. And you know, there were turban seers and crystal balls and workshops on travelling in the astral plane. At the back of this forum, there's a bearded man. He was a dead ringer for George Lucas, a safety goggle salesman by day, and a shaman by night who claimed to be channeling messages from the dead. And he pointed at me and said, "Young man with your arms folded, can I give you a message?" I said, "Sure." So he said, "I'm afraid, say, your job here in Montreal is only temporary. You're going to be leaving North America a lot sooner than you think." And this provoked mixed feelings because I just got my first legal job in Canada, and it turned out to be a money laundering organization for the Montreal Mafia, but I kind of wanted to stick it out. But the psychic said, "Pretty soon, you're going to be doing a lot of traveling. In fact, it's going to be your job to travel." Mm. I thought that could mean I'd be a pizza delivery boy, but he said, "I don't know what you do in life, but you're going to be putting together a book or a movie." So the psychic's prediction started to come true, and I lost my job, and I decided to return to Scotland. Mm. One day, I was sitting in the apartment, and the words cricket in Ukraine popped into my head, and I thought, what on earth does cricket in Ukraine mean? So I did a Google, and the search returned a few websites about insects in the Crimea. I thought, no, there's something I have to find. So I plowed through all the pages. Eventually, I found a little website about a cricket league at the Odessa State Medical University. And it's 16 teams. I thought, psychic, channeling messages about the future, I can kind of understand, but 16 cricket teams at a former USSR medical university. I thought that's a little strange and a story worth pursuing.
Early on, you conclude, and I'm quoting here, that cricket is a very dangerous pastime. One wouldn't have thought so. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I got into many scrapes on this tour. I think the liquor helped. At one point, I became embroiled in a drugs bust on the Midnight Express. Another point, I ended up lost in a Sarajevo graveyard at 2 a.m. with a paranoid Guatemalan anarchist.
One might wonder what all this has to do with cricket.
That's right. Well, this is essentially 95% travel disaster. You probably won't even know anything about cricket by the end of the book.
Well, some interesting terms do surface, but I'm curious about what was your best cricket experience during this tour?
One of the highlights was meeting the Istanbul cricket captain, Mr. Mubashir Khan, and I met him in his little sports shop in Istanbul, and he said to me that baseball bats were one of the biggest sellers in Istanbul, but there was no game there. It was only for beating people. And he was interested in importing cricket bats for the same reason. But he asked me, my friend, how long are you in Istanbul for? I said, 3 hours. And he said, what's your program? I said, it's very simple. I just need to get someone to throw the ball at me on the bridge over the Bosphorus, and I'm going to smack them from Europe into Asia. And his face drained of colour when I said this. He said, my friend, it's not possible because of all the suicides. You're not allowed on the bridge now. There's police everywhere. It would take weeks and special government permission. So anyway, we set off in the car through the rush hour and we zipped over the Bosphorus. Astonishingly, there were no police there for the first time. There was a little parking bay. So we scuttled along the edge of the bridge, crouched over as though there was a sniper in the girders, and he unleashed the ball and I launched him from one continent to the other.
For me, at least, the most tense portion of your book is the one in which you describe trying to get out of Belarus. I gather that you concluded that border guards who didn't understand English would certainly learn to understand it if only you yelled loudly enough and used enough four-letter words.
They forced me to leave by the opposite end of the country, and you only get 48 hours to get in and out. So I was out of petrol, I had no money because of all the police bribes throughout the country. So I took all my signed papers to the border, and everyone, all these babushkas with metal teeth and rakes and things on their shoulders, were screaming at me saying, banker, banker. And they sent me to this bank, which was a hut at the edge of the woods with a boy with a cash box. And unfortunately, there was no cash machine or petrol station for 150 kilometres. And he wanted €1.70 to get this signed chit to get me through the border. And I said, I'm terribly sorry, I don't have any money. And he said, get your family to help you. So I ran back to the car and I scrambled about the floor, found a €2 coin, I was over the moon, got back there, and he shook his head. He said, €2.70. And I thought, there's nothing for it. I'm going to have to stage a hold-up in this bank. So there were hot veins rising from my neck, and I was effing and blinding and screaming. And eventually, the line of terrified customers stumped up the 70 cents. And I said, thank you very much. As though nothing unsavoury had happened. But so I got my signed chit and I went to, got through the border. And I was like, yes, thank goodness. I'm like, oh no, there's another border. At this one, they wanted $10. They said my road tax had expired in the meantime. I thought, hard enough holding up a bank for 70 cents, but $10.
Well, you did eventually get out. You survived the trip, which was excellent, and odds on that might have seemed long at several points on the journey. Do you feel you did the sport of cricket any good through this traveling?
Well, it was a great way of bringing these countries together. Now, having done the trip, having done the book, there's teams from all over the world coming to play these Eastern European cricketers, so I think it's helped the growth of the sport there.
Now, when you returned home, you did get in touch with, I'm not sure if it was the same psychic or a different psychic.
I tracked this man down again. I felt I had to, you know. You don't want to go against the grain of destiny. And I said, well, you know, all I want to do is score 100, and I averaged 99 this cricket season. When am I going to get that 100? He said, 99? I don't know what that is, but haven't you gone far enough?
And you decided that finally, at least as far as touring unlikely cricket patches, you had.
I think what I realized then and there was that psychics are a lot like crack pushers outside primary schools. They give you that first fix for free so you come back for more.
Can we expect another book, or have you got that out of your system as well?
Well, after this cricket project, I'd love to go off and explore the outer limits of rugby, like naked rugby in Taiwan and underwater rugby in Norway, gay rugby in Sweden and Denmark. The book will be called Don't Put Your Tackle In Behind.
Angus Bell is the author of Batting on the Bosphorus, a liquor-fueled tour through Eastern Europe, published by Greystone. I'm not kidding. This book is for real. He joined me from the studios of the CBC in Montreal. Angus, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. We had help this week from Michelle Potvin at CBC Montreal and from Greg Hill at WUOT in Knoxville, Tennessee. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our old-time baseball photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from former Williams baseball player Kevin Morris, who describes his role last weekend's ball game, commemorating the first intercollegiate baseball game.
Well, I was a pitcher in college, and today I'll be doing a bunch of everything and nothing, I guess, all at once.
Sounds to me like this is a guy with a future as a host for a public radio sports program. I'm Phil Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.